A revolution is a struggle between the future and the past. In publishing, as we can see all around us at the London Book Fair in 2015, the revolutionaries are authors, editors, and artists, as well as scientists and data geeks. Whether they dress in Savile Row suits or heavy metal band t-shirts, these rebels are wrestling to get the future in a headlock before the future gets a chance to do the same. On behalf of Copyright Clearance Center, my name is Chris Keneally, and I want to welcome you to a kind of seance for scholarly publishing as we manage our way through a transformation of our industry. What's next for your business is what we are asking in the revolutionary age of open access. According to a recent industry report from Simba Information, article processing charges, APCs, the fees that publishers collect from authors for making their work available under open access rules, are expected to grow 80% from 2014 to 2017. Indeed, the recent projects, or the report rather, projects OA publishing revenues will rise at a pace far faster than traditional publishing models. Clearly, open access is here to stay. And the disruption that open access has generated has publishers rethinking business models and turning to technology for solutions. The revolutionary changes propelled by open access touches every aspect of publishing. New customers, new operations, new compliance requirements, new problems. In 2015, the OA challenge is to identify end-to-end solutions that manage the change, minimize the business burden, and maximize the publishing results. Our panel of thought leaders and executives from across the scholarly publishing workflow will address these issues in what I hope, and in fact I promise to you, will be a lively and interactive discussion. And we will make time for you, too, to ask your questions. So I want to start by introducing our panel. And starting from my far left, Dr. Neil Jacobs. Neil, welcome. Neil Jacobs is Head of Scholarly Communication Support at JISC. In this role, he is responsible for a range of JISC work that enables UK universities to implement open access efficiently and effectively, reflecting the policies of UK government and international research funders. He maintains close ties with UK research funders, libraries, research managers, and domain experts. And Neil, like many of the people on the panel, has been working on open access for a number of years and in the library and information processing, or the library and information profession, for over 20 years. So again, welcome. To my far right is Emma Wilson. Emma, welcome. Emma is Director of Publishing, Journals, and Databases for the Royal Society of Chemistry. She has over 15 years' experience working in the scholarly publishing sector. She's worked for both commercial and not-for-profit publishers, and she joined the Royal Society of Chemistry in 2006. Her current role has her responsibility for editorial, product, and policy development, including the shaping of the Royal Society of Chemistry's policies and products within the OA arena. To my near left is Diane Cogan. Diane, welcome. Diane is Sales Director for the UK and Europe for Ringgold. Ringgold supports a scholarly supply chain where information and data about subscribers, authors, readers, and content is able to flow easily and without confusion. Diane has worked in the STM publishing industry for a number of years, including at Reed Elsevier, where she was publishing director for their social science and economic publishing programs. And then finally, to my near right is David Ross. Welcome. As executive publisher for Open Access, David Ross has a global remit responsible for the strategic direction of Sage's OA journal programs, as well as managing their flagship OA titles, Sage Open, Sage Open Medicine, and Sage Open Medical Case Reports. And in recent posts to the Scholarly Kitchen blog, Joseph Esposito unpacked that Simba data that I mentioned to you to uncover the business significance of open access to publishing. And what he found was reason to believe that OA will help the business of scholarly and scientific publishing to grow in coming years. Open access has in fact evolved, Joe Esposito says, moving away from its Woodstock origins to a model that Wall Street would recognize. And in fact, he's mostly heartened, and I take some heart in this as well, that the growth in this business has been so significant And it is significant, not because of the size of it. It is approximately 2.3% of the total journals market today. But what is significant is how quickly that has happened. To start a business, and essentially that's what's happened in scholarly publishing, we've started businesses, new businesses, in open access. That is a very difficult thing to do, much more difficult than running established companies. And so, Emma Wilson, I'd like to ask you about that point. I know that the RSC's view of open access is this is an opportunity to innovate, which might surprise some people because, in effect, it sounds like a kind of a moment where you could tip over.
I mean, certainly building on from your points, I think open access is very much here to stay. It is part of the publishing landscape now. And we want to give, as a society publisher, we also need to support our community. Our authors and our members are asking for information about open access. And they also need, they want high quality outlets where they can publish their work open access, be that gold open access or potentially green open access as well. And we're very keen to support that need. We have seen there's a number of things that we do at the Royal Society of Chemistry in terms of supporting open access publishing. So we have, several years ago, we introduced our Gold for Gold vouchers, which was a very innovative scheme at the time. And these vouchers
enable... Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. I was going to say, these vouchers enable our customers, our customers that purchase all of our content, via that subscription, we give them Gold Open Access APC vouchers to a value of their subscription.
Essentially
cost.
A credit
yes,
against the subscription
exactly,
cost.
Exactly, yes.
Right.
And that enables us, that was an experiment at the time. We introduced it first in the UK, but there was a significant amount of interest into our kind of global customer base. And then we introduced it globally. And that experiment really allowed us to find out more about our customers' needs in terms of gold open access. And after that experiment, we also now have some proposals within the UK where we're selling vouchers as well. So people get some credit vouchers, the gold for gold, but we're also now going into those customers once they've finished those vouchers. And they want, if they want to purchase more vouchers for Gold Open Access Publishing, then we're also selling bundles of gold vouchers as well.
Right. So Gold for Gold was an experiment going back to 2006. But what I was trying to get at in my earlier question was that notion of experimentation really gave you confidence. I mean,
yes.
It allowed you to think through this question of open access and began to see various roads. And eventually, as you have seen at RSC and as many publishers are seeing, open access means a great many things. And it is now one business model among many for
yes.
scholarly publishing.
Yeah.
And that kind of confidence that you got out of that initial experiment has led you to try new things. So, for example, Chemistry Science is now going
yes.
to be entirely an open access journal.
Yes. So we took the kind of exciting, quite bold decision, actually, to flip our flagship journal, Chemical Science, which was under a subscription model, and we have now flipped that to a completely gold open access model.
Well, it sounds risky.
There are some risks to that because, you know, in this kind of brave new world, I think you do need to take some risks. We do have an APC waiver on that publication. But what we were very keen to do, and what I think was very important, particularly in the chemistry market, because we're publishing only in chemistry, we publish a very significant volume of articles, about 36,000 articles per year, but we are a chemistry publisher. And as you know, or as you may know, or I can let you know our experiences, is author behaviour within the physical sciences, particularly within chemistry, is there really isn't that kind of grassroots movement for open access publishing. Quite different author behaviour is seen in the chemical sciences than seen for particularly in the biomedical sciences and also some parts of the physical sciences.
Right, and we will hear more about that from David Ross, who will talk about Sage's experience in the social sciences. And I think that's an important point to make here. This whole movement, this revolution, really started within biomedicine and has kind of percolated throughout the scholarly publishing world.
Yes, and I think chemists are now are aware of open access, and the mandates make them aware. But I think really the point that I wanted to make was it was important from our perspective, and I think from our community's perspective, it was important to show leadership in terms of Gold Open Access. We wanted to make our flagship journal Gold Open Access. We wanted there also parts of the community were somewhat concerned about whether the open access part, the business model of the journal, affected the editorial standards of the journal. Now, we have consistently, as I'm sure everybody here would say, that is not true. The business model of a journal does not need to affect the editorial standards. But we wanted very much to make the statement within our community that our flagship journal, of where we would keep those editorial standards extremely high, can become a Gold Open Access publication.
Oh, okay, thank you, Emma Wilson. And Neil Jacobs, I want to bring you in here because community was a word that Emma used, and we're going to hear about a variety of communities in open access publishing throughout this discussion right now. And at JISC there, you represent a very particular community. For those who may not be familiar, not from the UK, briefly tell us what JISC is about.
Sure, thank you, Chris. So I represent JISC, which is an agency that represents universities and colleges in the UK. And we do several things relating to open access. One is we negotiate with publishers for access and on APC charges for universities. We also provide a range of services that universities will use to implement open access locally. And we provide support for those universities in terms of management, in terms of the libraries, to help them put in place the sorts of workflow systems that really they're only just beginning to put in place, as I think we all are.
Right, and that end-to-end solution, that approach of looking at things from the very beginning of the submission of the manuscript all the way through to publication and beyond is one that we have at Copyright Clearance Center, it's one you have as well. And there are overlapping communities there. So there's the community of the universities and the institutions, but of course many of the authors who are submitting articles and paying APC charges will be at those universities as well.
That's absolutely right. And, of course, it's in many ways in the UK where the block grants are available to universities. It's the universities who are paying rather than the authors, or at least on behalf of the authors. So universities are absolutely engaged in a way that they haven't been before, I think, at the point of acceptance, when an article is accepted, in assessing whether or not they want to pay that APC, whether or not they're getting the value and the service they require in order to fulfil funder mandates at that point, in a way that, you know, they haven't been involved at that stage of the workflow before. And I think that's a huge change in the supply chain that we're only just beginning to recognize.
Right. And the involvement is coming because of these compliance requirements that funders have put in place. And we're familiar mostly with Wellcome Trust, but also many UK government funding agencies have similar compliance requirements. And that's becoming increasingly seen as, if I could put it this way, an administrative burden. And it's a challenge for institutions.
It certainly is. There was a report last year which estimated that each payment of an APC costs the university around £81, which is, you know, reasonably significant if you scale that up to the number of APCs that are likely to be payable as the funder mandates take hold. So there is a real administrative burden challenge for universities, as there is for other stakeholders in the whole supply chain, and we need to work together to sort that out.
Well, indeed. And so, you know, I think the JISC view is that we're in the middle of a journey right now.
Oh, very much so.
But there's some bumps on the road.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right.
And you've recently published, just last month, what was called, interestingly for me at least, a desiderata. I love that word. I think it translates roughly as things to be wished for.
Yes.
And it was taking a look in a response to questions and entreaties from institutions for help in that particular challenge around compliance, and it's you feel that publishers, there are things publishers can do to help around that. Tell us a few. There are a number of points, but tell us the top three.
Okay. So this comes back in terms of some of the top three to the point I made earlier about the point of acceptance. So the point of acceptance when an article is accepted is the point at which an APC becomes payable, but it's also importantly for the UK and a very important point in the research excellence framework policy that the funding councils run. Now, that's a huge deal for UK universities. So this is where they get a huge amount of their research funding from, and it's going to be on the basis of whether or not articles are deposited into repositories at the point of acceptance. Now, universities are challenged by that because not all universities know when all of their articles are accepted. This has been a private matter between the journal and the author until now. But now the universities have a stake in it, and we would like to talk to publishers about whether or not at the point of acceptance, notifications can become available to both the authors in a structured way and to institutions in a structured way. And we can put in place middleware to help publishers do that and not have to maintain relationships necessarily with hundreds of universities. But whether or not the workflow and the supply chain at the point of acceptance can be changed so that those notifications from publishers are available.
Right, and I guess I'd want to underscore the point that from your point of view, authors, the people that work at these institutions, are really expecting from publishers assistance in all of this. They're looking to publishers for help.
They are looking to publishers for it. What we need to remember, and it's important to remember this, is that the policies apply to authors and institutions. The policies don't apply to publishers. So it's not that publishers need to comply with the mandates. It's simply that the institutions and the authors are looking and asking for help that they think publishers can provide.
Right. Well, David Ross, I'd like to turn to you now, because, again, back to that whole notion of community. Sage has a community of authors and readers and peer reviewers that you have turned to in a number of innovative ways. When we ask the question, you know, what's next for your business in open access, you've already begun to answer that question. And tell us about Sage Open, which is really the flagship journal for OA at Sage.
Yeah. I mean, I think the key issue here is that open access is not going to work the same way across all disciplines. We've touched on already that it started out in biomedicine, arguably, or maybe physics, if you can debate that, but a long time ago. But it is quite clear to see how that business model works in a field where there's millions and millions of pounds of research grants. Sage, traditionally, although we do publish quite a lot of clinical medicine these days, traditionally we've operated in the social sciences and a little bit in the humanities. And the struggle there for us was, how can you apply this model in an area where the funding situation is so different? In effect, there is no funding. It's dangerous to generalise across social science. In psychology, there is some funding. In theology, there isn't. I mean, and everything in between. So,
in God we trust, I suppose, in theology.
Precisely. They don't need the money. This is back to the experimentation side of this. We grappled with this, you know, back in, say, 2005, 2006, started thinking about this and thinking about different ways and would there be different models. And eventually we just decided, let's try it. And I think that is part of the role of the publisher in this whole business, is to innovate. And the only way to innovate is just to try things, to experiment. So we launched Sage Open, which was a broad spectrum mega journal, as they're now known. It wasn't known as that then, but that's what they're now known as, for all of humanities and social sciences.
And it really called together that entire community. I think that's the point.
I was going to say, that's the enormous challenge behind it. I mean, the funding side is the business model, and in that sense, Sage is willing to underwrite this for a period of time, and that may be years, decades. But the bigger challenge really was getting the social science community to understand what open access was. We had to overcome all the original concerns that the biomedics had about open access, about the quality issues, about the availability to non-funded areas or lower funded countries. And we had to come all that again, but explain it. And then to try and create an editorial board structure that enabled any piece of social science across the entire range to be reviewed was a whole other challenge.
And that itself was open, if I understand correctly. The peer review process.
Yes.
Right. And so I wonder whether that's a model you think could be replicated by anyone here. Is that an approach that is one that not only works in
could.
That particular instance,
it but could,
for but
others? It varies. Well, not all are. We leave the decision whether to open the peer review report to the peer reviewers themselves. That's what it comes down to. If they're willing for that to be available to the world, then fine. And I think that's where you'll find certain disciplines are more willing to do that than others. Certain peer reviewers, depending on where they are in their careers, you know, if they're criticising, if you're a very early stage researcher and you're criticising a very senior professor, you may not necessarily be willing to do that. So I think, again, that will vary throughout the market or vary throughout disciplines and within demographies within those as well.
Right. And there are a lot of risks here. Emma Wilson talked about the risk to a society like the Royal Society of Chemistry that you know, subscriptions and the revenue that they provided really supported the society's activities. SAGE is working with hundreds of different societies for publishing reasons, but it's still a privately held company. So the risk of going in this direction must have been one you had to calculate fairly carefully.
I don't really see, and SAGE doesn't really see that much of a risk here. I see it's additive. Sure, and an example of that is that this surprised us. When we started SAGE Open, we thought, you know, it's a mega journal. It sets out only to, you know, the barrier to entry is very low. Is it sound research? Is it good research? We'll publish it without any concerns about novelty. And we assumed it would be, you know, third or fourth down people's pecking order. On the surveys we've done since, 70% of authors' first choice was SAGE Open. So that, to me, just shows how additive it is. These are people, and when we've dug into that, we've said, so exactly why? And they're like, well, I've got a cross-disciplinary piece of work that doesn't really fit quite anywhere, and so I thought this is where it would go.
Right.
So it's additional to what
right.
we do.
And that's to Joe Esposito's point, that we've moved from a kind of a Woodstock free love model to a Wall Street model where it's a business, essentially.
Yeah. Yes, although SAGE Open isn't financially viable at the moment, so I'm not sure we'll be happy about
it. All right. Well, we need to tell people, I think, that SAGE has just announced, in fact, in Publishers Weekly today, that you have chosen to work with RightsLink for open access, copyright clearance centers, end-to-end solution. And there were some reasons for doing that, but I think they really underscore what SAGE is about, the kind of publishing you do. And essentially, it was a speed to market. You needed to have that kind of flexibility and configurability.
Yeah, I mean, so about 2 years ago, we took a decision to rapidly, on the back of the success of SAGE Open in terms of the interest in it, to really ramp up our open access offering. And that's our kind of like born gold open access journal. So we've had a huge launch program developing over the last 18 months, probably. And we've taken a step change in the number of APCs we're processing. And like a lot of the other traditional publishers, we're dealing with legacy systems. You know, SAGE's 50th anniversary this year. Our systems have all been built around subscription model, journal level systems to transact with the librarian as a main partner, and that is not applicable to open access. So, we took the strategic decision rather than actually go through all the pain to try and build these things ourselves to go with what I considered at the time the market leader in solution in a workflow solution for that.
Well, thank you for that. But it's also important to say that you're responding to the needs of your authors. I mean, again, I want to stress that word community. The community is looking for open access solutions. The authors that are contributing to these journals. You need an answer. And you find yourself working with people you might have not worked with in the past, such as Neil Jacobs.
Yeah, although we've always worked quite closely with JISC, so I wouldn't go that
far. In a different way, I guess.
in a very different way. And I think everyone's changing their way. I mean, in order to expand or to continue to roll out open access, particularly in the UK at the moment, we need workflow solutions. So that's where JISC comes in. They are developing institutional level or national level workflow solutions. At a more individual level, I think because when you're in a pay-to-publish mode, you're moving sort of like to B2C publishing almost, and you've got to make the experience good for the author as well. So that's where efficient payment processing comes in. They're not, they are more direct customers. If they keep getting knocked out by failing websites, they may not come back. So that all changes the nature of the conversation a little bit.
Right. And Neil, if I can bring you back, because there's a pilot you've been working on with various publishers, I believe including with SAGE, the JISC router. People here may have heard about that. Tell us a bit about how that will work. I know you're still figuring it out.
Well, we are still figuring it out. Can you hear me? No. We are still figuring it out, but we do have a working prototype, and it is working with at least one publisher, and we hope to have more on stream soon. So really this
comes... What's the principle for it?
The principle of it is, it comes back to what I was saying before about universities need to know now when an article has been accepted. So the principle is that if a publisher can notify the router that an article has been accepted with a little bit of metadata, the router can then pass that information on to the relevant institutions, all of the relevant institutions. And we can do that because the router will have a way of identifying which institutions are relevant to which authors and so on. So it's sort of a one-stop shop for publishers. The idea is we don't necessarily want to... we want to ease the administrative burden for institutions, but we want to do that in a way that also eases the administrative burden for publishers as well.
Right. And certainly easing administrative burdens is going to happen in this digital technological age, through technology. It's going to require technology solutions. And those technology solutions are going to be underwritten by standards. And that's really, I think, a fundamental point that JISC is concerned with.
Yep, we've worked very hard on standards. And, we've got Diane here from Ringgold. And, I think this is a cue to bring Diane in, talk about some identifier solutions here. We have, the router will rely on digital object identifiers, will rely on Fundref, will rely on ORCID. I'm not sure whether it will rely on Ringgold, at least initially, but that's another identifier in the mix. And these things, the adoption of these things is absolutely critical to get this workflow working.
And I think the earlier the better, because what JISC is after, and I'm sure what the publishers are after, is clarity when it comes to knowing who the author is, the institution, understanding what the licensing allows for and what it doesn't allow for. So really, it's about that. So the sooner, the better.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more.
Right. Well, so Diane Kogan, it is your cue to talk about standards, because when we think about what's next for your business when it comes to open access, what's next is taking on board all of these standards and really making sure that we see the industry apply them in a kind of efficient way. And tell people briefly about what Ringgold is. You're not new. Ringgold's been around for quite some time. So open access may seem new to people in the audience, but Ringgold's been at this standards notion for some time.
Certainly, yes. Ringgold's just entering its 10th year now, so we've been around a long time. And we deal with institutional standards. So we have a database of 400,000 institutions, all with a unique identifier. So standards are very, very important to us. But also, I think what's come out of the discussion today is how we link everything up in the scholarly supply publishing supply chain. So that you're linking that author ID, the ORCID, at the beginning of the process, to the funder ID through the Fundref registry, perhaps the institutional as well, because, of course, that's very crucial for paying the APC, so that those are all linked together. And so someone doesn't have to keep keying things in. It's in the metadata. It's preserved, and it communicates through the metadata. So I think that's really important. And quite a lot of people, we're working with a number of people. We work with ORCID because they use the database that we have as an authority file for the institutional part of the ORCID. We also work with Elsevier, who help to supply information to the Fundref database through their SciVal funding tool. So they use the database as a reference database. And we're also working with the editorial submission people like Ares and also Scholar One now, so that you can capture that institutional piece of metadata right at the very beginning of the submission process, and that can feed through along with the ORCID ID and along with the Fundref ID. So all of those things are captured, which can then help when you're starting to pay APCs. You know where the author is, who they are, and who's funded them. So immediately you have all that information in the metadata for that record, and you can then start to apply the APC. I mean, the many, many different types of APC right. models.
Well, and for article processing charges, what's really critical in all of this, I think there are a variety of people in this community, but the funders are the ones who have imposed the mandates.
Absolutely, yeah.
David Ross was telling me there's something like 400 different mandates out there around the world. There's a new one almost every day, not only from the UK, the US, China, across the world. And these kinds of standards enable reporting for compliance purposes.
Yes, absolutely.
And without that, we're not going to get the compliance that people are looking for.
No, well, because I think before people weren't compliant, and now they have to be compliant, otherwise they won't be funded. So.
Right, but the standards will mean something in the future, not only for the funders, obviously important, but it's going to make a difference for the publishers and how they do their business as well.
Absolutely, they need to track who's doing what, and the institutions need to track who's doing what as well at their institutes, so it's very important that they track their own data. But I would say something here, the importance of good data, as you probably know, that is crucial, because you can have all the identifiers you like, but unless they're linked to good data, which is consistent and unambiguous, it doesn't work so well. But we're getting there with the ORCID and Fundref. So.
Right. Emma Wilson, with regard to that notion of data, we can't have a discussion at a publishing event any longer. Before long, we'll bring up standards, we'll start talking about data. It's critical to what you're trying to do as well at RSC.
You mean in terms of the BACS systems, in
That's
terms
right.
of the metadata? Yes. And I think, you know, just to echo some of the challenges that you found at Sage as well, because we are working in a mixed economy, the vast majority of our systems are and author support is really around, you know, the older subscription model. So now, obviously, with Gold Open Access, with the block grants in the UK, with these sorts of things, it is about joining up our back office systems in a way that is meaningful, and a way that both supports the institution in terms of reporting and compliance, and also our authors as well in terms and the you know, it quite an exciting few years ago, if I wouldn't have said I found this exciting, but now I was going to say, you know, quite an exciting thing would be is if within Scholar One, I mean, we use Scholar One as our submission system, but, you know, within Scholar One, if we had the Ringgold identifier, we already have the ORCID, we already have the Fundref, but that would really complete that picture, because traditionally publishers had their primary relationship was with their authors. However, in open access gold publishing, the institution is right in the centre of that as well. So that would be very exciting.
Right. and not to turn this into a discussion about standards, but it seems to me that the kind of experimentation that you've spoken about and the drive for innovation, which is coming, there's going to be more of it in the future. David Ross will probably agree with you. But that is made possible by having that good data, by having that clean data.
Yes. And one of the things that we're doing, because we don't quite have that, I mean, lots of people are doing a lot of good work on it, but we don't have that end-to-end solution at the moment. But one of the things that we are doing is offering to our customers, particularly in the UK, is we're taking quite a lot of that administrative burden if they're purchasing vouchers from us, and that we will report that data to the institutes and to the authors. But actually, a lot of that reporting is really the institutes need that, because they need to be, you know, now in the world of mandates, particularly in the UK, the institutions need to be confident that they are compliant with the funding agencies.
And David Ross, standards, you know, by their nature, can be a bit rigid. You've got to follow them pretty closely. And what you're looking for as well is flexibility. Is there a marriage of the two that's possible?
I don't know. There is. There has to be. Otherwise, we're never going to get anywhere. But I think it's more devising standards is one thing, adopting them or ensuring the sort of universal adoption to them of them is another way. And it's not just the actual identifiers and then the more metricized part of it either. It's the process itself. Like the RSC, we have a slightly different approach to sort of like vouchers, but we would do a similar thing where we have prepaid bulk deals with institutions, and within that, everything has to have an approval process, because it's not all you can eat, it's that they have to decide who can use what. And I would say, literally, that every single institution has a different approval process. So that's not about standard identifiers, that's about how it works within the institution itself. I think in the UK things are going to change then because of the hefty ref requirement is going to force a lot of this onto UK institutions, and I hope Just Router, ideally hope Just Router is going to provide a solution for that. But that's just the UK. Now that's 6% of the global research output. So these things are cropping up all over the world. And so, that's going to be another challenge, not a bigger challenge necessarily.
Well, it's funny because, again, we're looking into the future and what we're seeing is not a single model. We're not seeing a single notion of open access, but a kind of a multiplicity of views, an open access that sort of depends on what you mean by open. And Diane Kogan, standards can help enable that view of the world.
They certainly can. Are you thinking of the NISO?
That's correct. And just the notion that there will not be a one-size-fits-all in anything to do with scholarly publishing.
Absolutely not. But again, if you can capture what you can do, and it's interesting, I was at a talk by Todd Carpenter at NISO, and he was actually talking about the project that they're heading up to try and capture the use.
I should tell people, it's the National Institute of Standards Organization.
Organization, yeah. And they've been looking at what you can do with material that's open access. So they're trying to capture in the metadata whether something's free to read as part of the metadata. And the second bit is the type of license, because there are many, many types of license. You can freely use something, you can perhaps use something, but not commercially. You cannot make derivatives. There's lots and lots of different licenses. And what NISO is trying to do is capture a reference to the type of license, not the exact license, but a reference. So you're then thinking the next stage is, what do we do with this material? What can we do, just ethically, you know, that material's being used in the right way, as the author intended, or the publisher intended?
Yeah, Neil Jacobs, but just, I see you nodding vigorously there. That's something you agree with. But I wonder how you feel if you expected a few years back this world that we are now emerging into, which is a world of multiple views of open access, multiple business models, many different types of approaches. Did you anticipate that?
Yes, I think I probably... Well, I'm not surprised.
Into the future.
I'm certainly not surprised. In a way, you said one size doesn't fit all. And, in some ways that's true. Clearly we have mixed models. We're going to have mixed models for a very long time. But in some other ways, it's not true. So Crossref is one size. Crossref doesn't fit all, but it fits the vast majority. And some of those central services like Crossref, like ORCID, one size, you only really want one author identifier. That's what makes it unique. And so in some cases, it is going to be one size fits all. And then we need to think really quite seriously about the governance and oversight and setup of those sorts of organizations. There's been a really interesting blog post recently by Cameron Nalon and Jeff Builder from Crossref about the sustainability of that kind of infrastructure. And I think it's incredibly important that we all engage in that and look at the ways in which those data and those organizations are set up and made available.
Right. And the point that you made when we were chatting about this earlier, Neil, was that look which way the people are going and kind of build a path along where they have gone rather than telling them where to go.
Oh, absolutely. That's certainly the way that we've been working with institutions. So institutions trying to implement open access locally, they've started off with spreadsheets and little databases and have been trying to work out what their approval processes are, what their workflows are and so on. And it would be reckless, I think, and really counterproductive for us to go in and say, this is how it should work. We're going to build you a big shared service and it's all going to work like this. Because, the way you work out where to build the path is that you wait and see where the people walk, and where the grass gets worn away, that's where you build the path. And so that's the principle that we're adopting with JISC, and I'm sure that's the right one.
Right. And David Rush, finally, I want to recommend something that's available from NISO, actually, from their journal, which is a recently published article you wrote called A Publisher's Perspective on the Challenges of Open Access. And what's the very most important thing that you put into this piece that you would want to convey to this audience of colleagues?
I think I referenced it in there, not standards. It does come back to all of it. If any of this is going to be scalable in any way, then it is the development and the adoption of standards.
And so standard solutions, we really have to have solutions that make this work from the beginning of that workflow that we've spoken about
to the very end, and that comes down
end.
To unique identifiers, and that comes down to national level workflows, and that comes down to such things like machine-readable mandates. There are 400-odd mandates. They need to be machine-readable. They're not at the moment. Licenses need to be machine-readable. All that. The only way, if you're going to continue to see what has been an enormously rapid expansion in the number of articles, the number of APCs being processed, and the number of compliance requirements, it's the only way it's going to work.
Great. Well, David Russ, thank you for that. I want to take an opportunity to turn to the audience right now, speak above the hubbub of the London Book Fair for just a few more minutes. I've got to get my handheld microphone. And I'm hoping that we have this. Right, so do we have questions here from the audience? I've seen people, again, scribbling notes, nodding vigorously, and I wonder whether, in fact, you want to challenge anybody here? If you have a question to clarify a point that's been made, if you have an experience that you want to share from your own publishing business. Yes, okay. Let me come over to you. And if you have a question for somebody specifically, tell us who it is.
This is a question for Neil, really. You mentioned the first one of the current disc desiderata, and I wondered what the second and third ones were.
There's more than three. In fact, there's quite a number.
There are 15, I think, at the last count.
That's like a kid's list of Christmas.
I can't see it getting any shorter either. I suppose, look, the next one I think really is key for institutions is to understand much more clearly what the publisher and the journal level policies are on open access. So many of you will have heard of the Sherpa Romeo service that we run, which interprets and tries to make it clear to authors and to institutions what they can do with preprints, with accepted manuscripts, and with published versions of papers, with respect to putting them into repositories, with respect to complying with funder mandates. It would be incredibly useful if some of the lack of clarity sometimes around journal policies could be resolved. And we're working really hard with the Publishers Association and the ALPSP towards that. And I know it's not straightforward. I know it's difficult. But we would really like to make some progress on that.
And if clarity is the goal, I think everybody here would agree with you. And certainly from Copyright Clearance Center's perspective, bringing all these people from across that spectrum of workflow together to try to help bring clarity to it is really a great opportunity. I see a question here.
I'm trying to look at you because I'd like to ask you a question. First of all, I would like to remind all of us also about Gold Open Access not only being APC based open access, because we have a lot of very good journals that are not APC based but are actually gold open access. Anyways, I think about the pricing. I remember when Sage launched a journal with an APC of $99, and that created a lot of debate. It's a very interesting debate because it focuses on the level, an acceptable level of an APC. What is that? And we have seen, I mean, it's hard to say, but we hardly ever see any calculations when you have an APC of, say, 3,000 euros. That seems a lot. When I've been publishing journals in humanities, I know that very good journals don't necessarily cost 3,000 euros per article. So could you, perhaps you and all of you, somehow tell a little bit about the calculations behind APCs, please?
And David Russ, if I could throw it in, there are models of APCs too. We've been speaking about multiplicities here. Sage is an investor in PeerJ. It's another way of approaching this question of how do you price things?
Where to start with that one? I mean, the first thing is that $99 is not a financially viable level. It was a way to try and experiment in a market that wasn't used to open access APCs. And that has actually gone up to $195 last year. That's still not financially viable. There is an element of the mega journal model, which is a volume business model. And so, obviously, that's, you know, PLOS One is the best example there. Even as a not-for-profit, at their $1,350 at their volume, that's an extremely profitable journal that allows them to reinvest in their mission, which is to transform scholarly communication. So how you set the cost really depends on so many variables and the market you're operating in. You know, Nature state that it costs them $18,000 to publish an article because they reject 99% of the material that's submitted to them, and they manage that whole process. So, you know, publishing an article across all of scientific endeavour is not equal. All we're trying to do within Sage Open is try and find a way. And actually within, we've launched other social science, more niche journals since then at a zero APC. So that's, but we're underwriting those. And I think the way forward in those kind of fields will be a mixed funding model. So the PHA model, which is a community model, where everyone pays a membership fee effectively. You can argue about how sustainable that is, but time will tell. But certainly in the lower funded areas where $3,000 isn't available out of a $2 million grant, then it will be a multiple. We're seeing a bit of... I see it as a combination of a mix of institutional sponsorship, low APCs, and some other revenue streams, such as advertising and even in medical sort of commercial sales.
And Emma Wilson, if I can bring you in here. Sorry, over here. You have seen an explosion in the submission of articles as a result of these new models. And we've spoken about administrative burden. I don't know if we want to call it an administrative burden, certainly an editorial responsibility that comes with that. And so that's raising costs and requiring resources.
Yes, very much so. I mean, we've seen quite a significant increase in the Gold Open Access that we publish, although I should say most of that is done on a waiver system in some way or another. Long term, we see this as being a revenue generator as well. But obviously the APC costs, I would just agree with many of the things that you said. There are real and legitimate costs that go into that in terms of the editorial processes and in terms of the investment, the electronic platform and discoverability. Currently, our APC charges, we introduced hybrid journals in 2006, and we set our APC costs as a combination of the cost that we incur and we knew, and also about how it sat in the market of APC charges as well. And there hasn't been, I think it's just started now, that there's been much more of a kind of market for APC charges. And my own personal opinion is I think that's going to be quite a active area in the next few years as well.
Still very early days. Yeah. Okay, we have time for one last question. Anyone else here? Yes, just a moment.
Hi, I just had a question to anyone on the panel, really, around some clarity around what licensing governs AAMs in Green Open Access when something is, say, deposited in an institutional repository, because we've talked a little bit about it not being clear what you can do with freely accessible content, and that's one thing with gold papers when it's got a Creative Commons license. What about repositories?
Yeah. So this is a bit of a minefield.
Well, and we can have a whole session on that. Yeah.
And that's a long answer, but AAM is the accepted author's manual.
Yes, yeah. So we publish, we don't take copyright, we publish under a license to publish from our authors. And our accepted article manuscript is covered by that license. Our licenses, again, if I'm completely honest, it's implicit in that license that secondary licensing can happen in terms of that going into a repository. It's not that explicit. Also, what we expect, we also need to tighten up some of our policies around that. But that's currently how our green open access articles are done.
Great. So I want to thank Emma Wilson for that answer and... thank our panel here from, again, my left, Neil Jacobs with JISC, Diane Kogan, Ringgold, David Ross with SAGE, Emma Wilson with the Royal Society of Chemistry. I want to thank all of you. And you know, I understand there's an election going on here in the UK. Consider yourselves lucky. Yours only lasts 6 weeks. 6 weeks is about as long as it takes our politicians to clear their throats, all right? But I'll tell you, what we have found over there, it works in the U.S. if you're a politician, and it seems to me that it's true here as well, is that we are for a great many things and against darn few. My name is Chris Keneally with Copyright Clearance Center. Thank you very much for joining us today.